A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Random House Audio presents Star Wars Jedi Trial by David Sherman and Dan Cragg. Read for you by Jonathan Davis. Obi-Wan! Anakin Skywalker exclaimed, when the hologramic image of Jedi Knight Obi-Wan Kenobi appeared before him. Anakin had been pacing in his quarters, brooding over why he was consistently being passed by for his Jedi trials. The chance to prove he was a full Jedi Knight.
Anakin, how are you settling in?
Anakin shrugged. All right, I guess. Obi-Wan's smile dimmed. They had returned to Coruscant only 2 standard days earlier, but he was fully aware of how long 2 days without action could seem to Anakin. He knew his Padawan would not be pleased by the news he was about to break.
I just returned to my quarters from a meeting with the Jedi Council. I have an assignment which...
Already? Anakin interrupted, excited. I've barely begun to unpack. I can meet you at the spaceport in an hour.
I have a mission, Anakin. Not us. The Jedi Council is sending me alone. It's an individual assignment, a quick in and out.
Anakin was clearly trying not to frown. What am I supposed to do in the meantime?
You'll be debriefed on our last mission, for one thing. I'm trusting that to you. When I get back, I'll suggest to the Council that you're ready to begin your trials. I've got confidence in you, Anakin. You know that.
Yes. Anakin's expression softened. I know you do, Obi-Wan. May the Force be with you. 3 days later, Anakin Skywalker flipped his datapad off. He'd spent the time since Obi-Wan had left in the library, studying the campaigns and battles of the Clone Wars. He headed for the training area. Maybe he could find someone to spar with, to balance his inactivity. The war was a severe drain on the Jedi resources, and nearly every physically able Jedi was away from Coruscant on a mission or campaign. Anakin found only one Jedi in the training area, Najah Halcyon, drilling with his lightsaber. Anakin had met Halcyon once before, and found him to be not only intelligent and witty, but also a tactically sound Jedi. Obi-Wan had assured him his impression was accurate. And yet, Master Halcyon had been living in a state of semi-disgrace after losing his ship, Pluriad Bodkin, to a rogue ship's captain he'd been sent to apprehend. Moving with total focus and concentration, Halcyon was a pleasure to watch. Loath to interrupt him, Anakin remained on the side, waiting for him to pause. At last, Halcyon thumbed his lightsaber off and stood erect. He glanced over at Anakin and grinned.
Anakin Skywalker! Looking for a sparring partner?
Anakin started briefly.
You honor me.
Halcyon gestured an invitation, and Anakin entered the sparring circle. They faced each other and saluted, then took position and thumbed their lightsabers to life. Anakin made the first move, a thrust that started high before plunging downward to dip under an anticipated high parry. The blades of the lightsabers sizzled as Halcyon easily deflected the thrust, laughing when he danced aside.
You surprise me, Halcyon said mock-seriously. That's such a basic move. I'd have thought you'd have some new ones from being in combat.
He launched a flurry of thrusts and slices of his own. Anakin easily parried or deflected all of them.
Master Halcyon, Anakin said when they stepped back. In a fight, one seldom has time to invent new maneuvers. The tried-and-true movements are usually the most effective.
He reached out with his lightsaber to touch Halcyon's, then spun the tip of the blade in an unorthodox backhand that would have cut through Halcyon's left shoulder had he not stopped short, and had Halcyon failed to fall back out of the way in time.
Very good, Padawan. Halcyon nodded with approval. That was so close, I'm not sure whether or not it counts as a touch.
Anakin grinned.
You don't have time to invent in a fight, but sometimes you can improvise. Then they settled into serious sparring. After an hour, they stopped by unspoken mutual agreement. Both gleamed with sweat. Both were laughing.
Ah, yes, Halcyon said happily. A sparring partner makes the workouts much, much better.
He eyed Anakin.
Shall we do it again tomorrow?
Sounds great.
Same time, same place.
With pleasure. There was no word from General Kamar. Ice-cold prickles of fear shot up the back of Raja Momin's arms to her scalp and then down her spine. Everyone else was looking to her to remain calm. So she'd come out into the garden early, to relax, to gather her thoughts and compose herself before meeting with her staff. But it wasn't working. Eyes closed, Raja tried thinking of home. In 5 more years, her contract would be up and she would head back to Alderaan. Maybe. A breeze wafted in through the dome. It carried with it the aroma of the native grasses that grew in such profusion on the mesa, where the Intergalactic Communications Center was located. Raja Momin had accepted the job as chief administrator of the Intergalactic Communications Center on Preesitlin because she liked the work. The handsome salary counted only as a nice bonus. She worked hard and well because she enjoyed work as an end in itself, and she treated the people under her more as partners in a joint enterprise than as subordinates. And unlike so many busy bureaucrats consumed by their sense of self-importance, she knew when and how to relax. She opened her eyes and sighed. Relaxation was out of the question. Members of her staff were already filtering into the garden and finding places to sit. Not to enjoy the informal midday luncheon that had become a tradition in the year she had been chief administrator, but to get the news, to get their orders. Raja felt a brief flash of anger that her routine was being interrupted. Today, everyone spoke in worried whispers, all ears for any news from the south. What could she tell them? Not knowing what was going on there was worse than bad news. Several standard hours earlier, an invasion fleet had landed approximately 150 kilometers to the southwest of the center.
Mistress, General Kamar had said in his last report, 2 of our starfighters on a routine patrol over the ocean just off the coast have engaged a large number of hostile craft. The airborne control ship that was monitoring the patrol has been shot down, but before we lost contact with it, the crew reported a large droid army landing. The invaders don't appear to be as numerous as my own command, but they may be just an advance party preparing a foothold for a larger force. Either way, we have to destroy them without delay. I'm taking my main force overland to attack them.
How big is their fleet? She had asked.
Several transports and capital ships, nothing we can't handle. Should we need reinforcements, which I doubt, Sluis Van will supply them.
Wouldn't it be prudent to call for them now, just in case?
Kamar grunted.
We shall if we need to, but it wouldn't be good tactics to call for reinforcements before we know the extent of the enemy threat. I leave a detachment here under Commander Lanmore to provide security for the center.
But for the past hour, she had received no word from General Kamar. If this was an all-out attempt by the Separatists to seize the communication center, her comfortable little world on Preesitlin was coming to an end. The solar dome that roofed the garden slammed shut without warning. There was a bright flash and a deafening roar. Heart in her throat, Raja jumped to her feet and ran back inside the main control room. Slith Scale, the Sluicy chief of the communication staff, appeared beside her. She had never seen the methodical creature move so quickly or look so worried. "Is Kamar returning?" Raja asked hesitantly.
"No, mistress," Slith answered. "It is strangers."
He swayed nervously.
"I believe it is another invasion force. I ordered the dome closed when the first ship landed. I beg your forgiveness if you were startled. What are your orders?"
The control room was in chaos. Technicians babbled among themselves, working their instruments frantically. A deep-throated roar rumbled through the facility. She could feel the vibrations in the floor panels. "A large number of ships are landing below the mesa," a technician said with an edge to his voice that told Raja he was on the verge of panic. "Quiet, everybody. Listen to me," She called loudly and firmly. It was time to make order out of this confusion. "Everyone take your places and listen." Her calm, controlled demeanor had the desired effect. People stopped babbling and took their seats. "Now," she said, turning to Slith, "send an alert to Coruscant and tell..."
"I already have," the Sluicy answered. "The transmission was blocked."
"That's not possible," she said, startled.
"Evidently it is," Slith answered matter-of-factly. "What are your orders, please?" he repeated.
Raja was silent for a moment.
"Commander Lanmore?"
"I am here, mistress."
Lanmore stepped up and drew himself to attention beside her.
"What is your assessment?"
"It's not looking good,"
Lanmore answered in precise, clipped tones.
"We cannot hope to hold out against them without immediate reinforcement. And," he hesitated, "that will not happen."
"Any word from General Kamar?"
"No, mistress, and..."
Lanmore's voice caught.
"We must assume that he has been defeated."
Raja considered for a moment.
"Very well, then.
Somehow the invaders are blocking our transmissions. General Kamar cannot help us. We cannot resist. Listen to me, everyone. We cannot let this complex fall into the invaders' hands."
She paused for a moment to gather herself before announcing an order she'd never dreamed she'd have to give.
"Destroy your equipment." Quickly, she began instructing individual technicians, directing them to disable specific pieces of equipment first.
"Commander."
"Yes, mistress."
"Can you delay the invaders? All we need is a few minutes."
"I can try."
Lanmore was perspiring faintly, but he turned sharply on one heel and left the control room.
"Get busy,"
she ordered the technicians, many of whom had stopped to listen to her conversation with Lanmore. The Intergalactic Communications Center was vital to the Republic, and its facilities could not be allowed to fall into enemy hands. From outside on the mesa came the crashing roar of weaponry. Lanmore's troops were engaging the invaders. Raja felt a rising sense of despair. Her comfortable world was at an end.
"Count Dooku wishes a status report, Tawnith."
The Ma'oon commander of the invasion force, Admiral Porz Tawnith, quietly sipped his Dianogan tea and smiled, ostensibly ignoring the disrespect clear in the way the bald and tattooed commander, Asajj Ventress, addressed him.
"He has the complete battle plan, Ventress," he replied easily, showing her the exact same level of disrespect.
He set his cup on a nearby sideboard.
"I gave it to him before I left. He knows that once I have developed a plan, I carry it out."
He smiled amiably, purple-stained lips parting to reveal matching purple teeth and black gums, and affected the tea. Ventress's expression didn't change, but her dark eyes flashed through the holonet receiver like two burning coals.
"A plan is not a status report."
Tawnith sighed dramatically. "Really, I cannot command this expedition if I am to be interfered with by.
He shrugged and reached for his teacup.
"The report?"
"I am extremely busy just now."
"Make your report to me now."
Her voice cut through the vast distances, like the lightsabers she was reputed to wield so expertly. Tawnith shrugged languidly and bowed to the inevitable.
"As we speak, a fleet of 126 ships, 75 of them capital ships, is investing Sluice Van to block any reinforcements from that sector. I am at this very moment landing a force of 50,000 battle droids and Presetlin in a feint to divert the garrison from the Intergalactic Communications Center. When that operation is fully underway, I will land the main force, composed of, give or take, 1 million battle droids, crush the defenders in a containment maneuver, and capture the center intact. I have 200 ships in my invasion fleet. This operation cannot possibly fail. I guarantee you that within 24 standard hours, Presetlin will be ours. We will sit firmly astride the communications link that connects the worlds of the Republic. Our forces will be poised at this strategic crossroads to strike without warning at any of the Republic's allies. Most important, our control of Presidlin will be a vibroblade thrust directly at Coruscant itself. He stabbed his arm forward as he spoke. This is the move that will win the war for us, he concluded, a confident smirk on his purple-stained lips. They'll never know what hit them, those technicians and their security forces. They'll soon all be dead, or be assets belonging to us. He sat back and sipped at his tea. Ventress did not seem impressed.
The electronic countermeasure suite?
Fully operational. The center tried to dispatch a pan-galactic distress signal a brief while ago, but it was successfully blocked. He smiled, showing his purple teeth and black gums.
The stealth suite? Your fleet is undetected? You have achieved tactical surprise?
Yes. Not just tactical surprise, but strategic surprise, not to put too fine a point on it.
Very well. Count Dooku will require regular updates as your campaign progresses. You will direct them to me, so get used to it now.
Yes, Tarnath answered, his voice tinged with false resignation, making clear that he thought he was succumbing to a nuisance he could do without.
By the way, I'm impressed by your interesting dental work.
I thank you, he said, bowing at the hologram. And I compliment you on your unusual choice of hairstyle. Ventress nodded, and her image vanished. Luck, good or bad, is the great unknown factor in war. Often the outcome of battles, the fate of entire worlds, is determined by luck. It was luck of one sort or the other that placed Lieutenant Irk Harmon of the Presidlin Defense Force and his Torpal T-19 Starfighter on patrol along the southern coast of the continent on which the Intergalactic Communications Center was located, about 150 kilometers from the center itself, when the invasion began. He and his wingmate were cruising at a leisurely 650 kilometers per hour at 20,000 meters. For the Torpal T-19, 650 kilometers per hour was almost standing still.
Looks like a big sandstorm down there,
Irk's wingmate Ensign Pleth Strom commented. Starfighter pilots considered atmospheric flying the worst possible waste of their skills, and both men claimed, at every possible opportunity, that their tour with the Presidlin Defense Force was a form of punishment for some unspecified transgression. It wasn't, of course, but rather the luck of the assignment system. Their numbers had come up, that was all, as they knew perfectly well. But if hotshots like Irk and Pleth weren't showing what they could do by taking on the entire Separatist fleet, they complained about being misused by their commanders. I hate to land anywhere on this blasted rock, Irk said with a laugh. He consulted his planetary navigational chart. Nothing here even has a name.
That's Area 62, South Continent.
Genthgrek 5-1, cut the chatter. This is a combat patrol. And please get off the guard channel. Go to 8.64.
1,000 kilometers away, high over the ocean, Waterboy, the petite ensign on board JG-51's airborne control ship, smiled. She knew both Irk and Pleth well, and knew they were talking over the open channel just so she would butt in. Channel 8.64 was the discrete encrypted frequency, a scrambled frequency that hopefully no potential enemy could intercept.
Copy. Switching to 8.64, Irk said laconically. And begging you to have a beer with us tonight, Waterboy.
She said cut the chatter, JG-51.
A strong male voice interrupted.
Copy that, sir, Irk replied.
Approaching,
the female voice shouted in the next instant. Waterboy, repeat that transmission, Irk requested, frowning.
Marks! Lots of them!
Pleth shouted at the same instant Irk's warning system buzzed. Now Irk saw them, a swarm of tri-droids emerging at great speed from a cloud of dust on the surface.
Instantly, Irk became a functioning component of his fighter.
Arming, he reported casually.
Break to starboard, he ordered Pleth. He put his machine into a half-roll and commenced a steep dive to port. Irk's fighter flashed through the approaching formation of enemy ships. Several fired at him as he roared groundward. As soon as his target acquisition system ranged in on the enemy fighters, his blaster cannons began pumping lethal bolts into their underbellies as he approached from astern. He had less than a second to acquire and fire at a target, and still enemy ships exploded all around him as he flew through their formation and soared far above it. He had lost sight of Pleth. Confused by Irk's lightning attack, the tri-droids quickly formed a protective circle at 15,000 meters. Irk laughed out loud. He came up under them again, firing at very close range, as the first target vanished beneath the nose of his fighter.
You're six,
Pleth warned suddenly. High-energy bolts lanced past Irk's cockpit from astern. Irk instantly went into an inverted roll, pulled hard into a vertical dive, and pulled out in the opposite direction from his attackers. He climbed back up and took them from astern. Both exploded.
Too many of them!
Pleth shouted. Copy that, Irk replied calmly.
Break! Water boy!
Say again, water boy, Irk said in response to the garbled call from the controller aircraft.
Going in,
a female voice replied calmly, and then there was nothing but static. Irk switched back to the scrambled frequency.
Head for home, Pleth. Water boy is down. Repeat, water boy is down.
Since they were only 150 kilometers from base, Irk descended to within meters of the surface, where the enemy craft would have difficulty tracking them against the ground clutter, and gave his engines power. They would be back at base in less than 60 seconds, muster the rest of the squadron, and return to do permanent damage to the invader's fighter screen and the landing party.
Bad luck about Waterboy.
They were both thinking of that young ensign.
Yeah, Irk thought. Very bad luck.
Skill, not luck, had brought Odie, Subu, and her speeder bike undetected to a spot just behind the crest of a ridge where she could observe the enemy landing force deploying on the plain below. She was a member of a reconnaissance platoon General Kamar had spread out before his army to develop intelligence about the enemy landing force. The orbital surveillance system had been destroyed or was being electronically jammed, and the recon drones the Defense Force had sent out earlier had failed to report. Odie lay prone beside her speeder, just below the military crest of the ridge. Inside her helmet, a tiny voice whispered,
"Droids."
It was another soldier from her squad, deployed somewhere farther down the ridge from her position. The recon trooper was too excited by what he saw to use proper comm procedure, and because of the distortion caused by all the jamming equipment in use, she didn't recognize his voice. Probably Tammy, she thought, but they were all excited. Except for Sergeant Max Maganini, the recon squad leader, this would be their first taste of combat. From her position, Odie could clearly hear the roar of landing ships and the rumble of heavy equipment rolling into position. Cautiously, she crawled to the top of the ridge and deployed her electrobinoculars, making delicate adjustments. Suddenly, a sharp image of thousands and thousands of battle droids leapt into view. The screen readout indicated a range of 1,250 meters. Odie's TT-4 binocs, the only pair in the squad, began recording images that would be invaluable to General Kamar when she got back, if she got back to the main body. Sergeant Maganini had given her this pair because she was the best rider he had.
Lots of them,
Tammy whispered. Odie's heart began to beat faster. She had never seen real fighting machines up this close.
Use proper procedure and keep the comm open,
Sergeant Maganini grunted. Another ship landed on a vast plume of fire and smoke. Huge clouds of dust rose into the air to obscure the craft. Odie increased magnification to reveal any markings on the landing ship. A concussion wave, like the side of a Wookiee's hand, slapped up against Odie's helmet from a hit of 100 meters down the ridge from her position. Other hits began impacting all around her, and then she was being buffeted left and right. Her body shook like a rag. The concussions were so powerful, the breath whooshed out of her lungs. The entire ridgeline exploded in huge gouts of fire and dirt. The tactical channel inside her helmet erupted with screams and shouts. She could feel moisture gathering inside her suit. Was it blood? Or... someone cursed foully over the comm. Only Sergeant Maganini talked like that.
Get out!
The transmission ended in a painful grunt. That was all Odie needed to get going. She slithered back down the ridge, carefully put the precious electrobinoculars with their invaluable recordings inside their case, and righted her speeder. The speeders used by the recon squad were not made for military purposes, but were a civilian version that the military techs in the Presetland Defense Force had modified. Yet another economy measure that the force had been required to adopt. If the enemy had speeder scouts riding 74Zs and they came after her, she would be in trouble. Her speeder was no match for the 74Z, with its high maneuverability, speed, armor plate, and onboard weapons. All she had with which to defend herself was a blaster pistol. But Odie knew the ground between here and General Kamar's army, and she could use that to advantage if she were pursued by ground troops or even by aircraft. She also had another advantage. She could outride almost anyone in the galaxy. The run she was about to attempt was what she lived for. Using the ridge behind her as cover, she roared off at top speed, 250 kilometers per hour, hugging the ground contour at less than a meter. About a kilometer from the ridgeline, she drove into a deep arroyo and reduced her speed. Suddenly, her heart froze. Just above her, but out of sight over the lip of the canyon, she heard the roar of another speeder bike. Her practiced ear told her the bad news. It was not one of hers. She pulled to a stop in the deep shadows beside the canyon wall and took off her helmet to hear better. Carefully, Odie eased her blaster out of its holster. She slung her helmet behind her. She shook out her short brunette hair. It was damp with perspiration and gritty with sand. Safety off her blaster and her finger off the trigger, she drove her speeder with one hand, easing it forward cautiously. Ahead, the ground rose steeply. She paused, looking up the slope over a jumble of fallen rock to where the canyon rose to the surface. She came out of the canyon at 200 kilometers per hour. A trooper sat on a speeder bike right in front of her. She snapped one shot at his center of mass, but didn't wait to see the bolt slam into him and knock him completely off his speeder. Instantly, she wondered if she should return and take his vehicle. But her training took over, and that saved her life. She zigged sharply to the left and then back to the right, just as a high-energy bolt zapped over her shoulder, fired by a second trooper she hadn't seen off to one side. He roared after her. With its superior speed, his machine shot past in a blur. He made a tight turn and came charging straight back at her. She stopped abruptly and fired, but missed as he flashed by. The trooper's shot went far wide. She could have sworn he grinned as he passed her. 100 meters ahead rose a jagged rock formation, weathered into a jumble of bantha-sized boulders that extended several kilometers in the direction Odie wanted to travel. She drove her speeder into it and hid behind a huge boulder, waiting to ambush the trooper if he was stupid enough to come in after her. He wasn't. Something flashed overhead. It was the military speeder, traveling at top speed about 25 meters above the rocks, too fast for her to get off a shot. She moved farther forward into the rock formation, cautiously edging her speeder ahead at slow speed. A series of huge boulders blocked her path. She could see no way around them and dared not take a chance of going over, even if her speeder could make the height. The only way through was via a gap about 15 meters wide. She took a deep breath and entered the narrow declivity. The shadows deepened into twilight between the rocks, plunging some areas into near-total darkness. Her heart suddenly skipped a beat. Was that a noise off to the left in that patch of darkness? She reached for her blaster. "Freeze!" a voice commanded. The trooper stepped out of the shadows, holding a blaster aimed directly at her chest. "Don't move," he ordered. Odie leaned forward, preparatory to making a break for it. and the trooper fired a warning blast in front of her. In the brief flash of light, she was surprised to see another figure lurking in some shadows just a little way behind the trooper, heading toward him.
Two of them?
The trooper's head turned slightly in the direction of the approaching figure. At the same instant the figure fired his blaster, Odie gunned her speeder forward. Amazingly, the blaster bolt was aimed not at her, but at the other trooper, who staggered back into the shadows, a jagged steaming hole in his chest.
Odie!
A man's harsh voice called out. She applied the brakes instantly. She'd know that voice anywhere. It was Sergeant McGinnity. He staggered toward her, his blaster hanging loosely in one hand. Even in the dim light, she could see that he was hurt. He swayed in front of her, a twisted smile on his face.
Good to see you again, he rasped.
General Kamar turned to his chief of staff. Let's move. We can take these droids. Get our armored infantry and artillery onto this high ground here. He jabbed a finger at a three-dimensional terrain map. Dig in. Get them to come to us. Hit them with every fighter we've got right now to cover our advance. Odie had brought the injured McGinnity back to base. She stood quietly at attention, while the general and his staff used the information she had gathered to plan their attack. She wondered about the fate of her comrades, none of whom had been heard from. At last, Kamar turned to her. At ease, trooper. You are one brave soldier, and pretty lucky to boot.
I was scared all the time, sir, and I didn't need any luck. Sergeant McGinnity backed me up when I needed him.
The general looked at her for a moment, then nodded. Well, he said, now you know what really makes an army work. General Kamar and several of his principal staff officers were observing the invaders from the same ridge where Odie had watched them barely hours before. Kamar had succeeded in reaching the ridge before the enemy deployed and quickly established a strong defensive position. So far, the invaders had been content to direct only harassing fires against Kamar's force, but had made no attempt to attack him. An army of an estimated 50,000 droids was sitting down there without making a move against him. What could they be waiting for?
Sir, they can't flank us. We have strong forces to both sides, an officer observed. If they're going to attack, they have to come at us straight up the slope. We'll cut them to pieces if they do. They must be waiting for reinforcements.
General Kamar frowned thoughtfully as he rubbed the stubble on his chin. Suddenly, the general knew with absolute clarity what was about to happen. He turned to the hologram map of his positions and the surrounding terrain and put his finger on a vast, jumbled rock formation about 10 kilometers behind his line.
I want a redoubt established here, he said, speaking rapidly.
Start moving our troops on the double. Move fast but in small increments. Infantry and support troops first. If the enemy gets wind of a retrograde movement and attacks, I don't want the bulk of our troops caught in the open. Have the combat engineers go in with the first group to fortify the area. Armor and mobile artillery will lay down a barrage on the enemy to keep his head down. They'll move last, to hold onto this ridge until the last possible moment until we can secure that area, then withdraw into it. How many fighter craft do we have?
A full wing is operational, sir, but if...
Good, we can use the air assets to cover our withdrawal.
But sir, another officer protested. We have a classic defensive position where we are. They can't possibly break through here.
They aren't going to break through here. And that is not the main force, the general announced quietly. We've been duped. The main force hasn't landed yet. When it does, it'll land behind us, between this position and the center.
This force,
he nodded down the ridge,
is the anvil. The hammer is about to strike. From behind us.
I have a mission for you.
Odie stood at attention before the reconnaissance platoon commander and another officer whom she recognized by his collar tabs as an engineer.
This is Colonel Crean, the commander of our engineer battalion.
That rock formation where you met Sergeant Maganini. I want you to take Colonel Crean back there. Right now.
Yes, sir, Odie responded. Let's go, trooper,
Colonel Crean said. He stepped off with a short nod at the lieutenant. As he and Odie briskly headed for the engineer battalion's bivouac, he briefed her on the mission.
I have a convoy of cargo skiffs all loaded and ready to go. I want you to lead it back to that rock formation, where they'll unload and prepare another defensive position. Are you ready to leave right now?
Yes, sir,
Odie replied enthusiastically. Reconnaissance trooper Odie Subu straddled her speeder as she closely watched the 300 vehicles of the engineering battalion finish forming up for the rearward movement to the redoubt. There were dirt movers, bridgers, graders, ground clearers, diggers, and more exotic machines whose uses she couldn't guess. The most numerous, though, were cargo carriers, many of which were marked with symbols she recognized as indicating their cargoes were explosive ordnance. She estimated there were enough explosives in the convoy to obliterate the Army's entire position.
Recon scout.
Colonel Crean's voice came through her helmet comm.
Recon here, sir, she said into her mic.
We're ready. Move out.
Odie took a last look at the convoy. Whatever route she chose had to accommodate the largest of the engineering vehicles. The shake of her head went unseen inside her helmet. The largest of those machines was so big, she was going to have to lead them in a roundabout manner.
Moving out, sir,
she said, and eased her speeder forward. She wasn't able to lead the convoy at speed, not even the paltry 250 kilometers per hour that was all her speeder was capable of. Over this rugged terrain, she had to keep her speed down to under 50 kilometers per hour, which was the fastest the slower vehicles in the convoy could manage. At times, she had to slow to little more than a trot for them to keep up. And sometimes, she had to slow because Colonel Crean said they were raising too much of a dust cloud. The distance they had to cover was only 10 kilometers, line of sight. But the route she had to follow, this way and that, and sometimes doubling back, made it nearly four times that distance, and more than four times the length of time to cover. But at last they made it. She stopped and pulled aside, while the engineering vehicles trundled past. Colonel Crean had his command vehicle pull off the trail next to her.
Well done, trooper, he said. I'll see to it General Kamar and your platoon commander both get a report on how well you did. Now you'd better get back.
Thank you, sir.
Odie saluted and waited until the engineering commander was back in his vehicle before she turned her speeder around and gunned it. She headed back at top speed. Lieutenant Irk Harmon knew he was going down, but even as he plummeted toward the ground, he remained cool, calling upon every fiber in his body and all the skill he could muster to save his starfighter. The hit from the enemy fighter had slammed into him like a hammer and sent him into an uncontrolled spin downward. He had only just been able to pull out and stabilize his machine at a mere 1,000 meters above the ground. His hydraulic system was failing fast, and he knew he had but two choices: eject or ride his fighter in. This was the most target-rich environment Irk and his fellow pilots had ever encountered. Not even in the many simulated practice sessions had anyone thought to program this many marks. The fight continued far, far above Irk. The enemy was winning. But now Irk Harmon was intent on saving his life and, if possible, his ship. A dust storm had developed below, obscuring the terrain. Irk's suit was filled with perspiration, and he knew he must have lost 2 liters of fluid during the dogfight. Already, that loss of fluid was making him thirsty. But he had no choice. He'd have to go down in the storm. He made his decision. Well, old girl, he muttered as he struggled to keep a starfighter level. I'm not going to leave you. He would go in with his fighter. Odie was only halfway back to the main army after guiding the engineers to the rock formation where they were to dig the new defensive positions when the storm hit. With a suddenness and ferocity typical of such events on Presidlin, the wind quickly rose to 50 or 60 kilometers an hour, buffeting her from all sides and making controlling her speeder difficult. She stopped and zipped up. She dismounted, and turning off the repulsors,
She tipped her speeder over and curled up beside it to wait out the storm.
A ground-shaking roar, momentarily louder than even the howling wind, washed over her as an enormous object passed no more than 10 meters above where she lay. She heard a screeching, smashing noise as if some metallic object had impacted. Some distance off to her right, there was a brief reddish glow that was immediately obscured by the rolling clouds of dust. A fighter had just crashed only a short distance from where she lay. She lay beside her speeder, undecided whether to investigate. The wind suddenly abated somewhat, and raising her head above the frame of her speeder, Odie saw a faint glow from the downed fighter's engines. She righted her speeder, mounted, and started out toward the downed machine. As she eased her way along, she unsnapped her holster and withdrew her blaster pistol. When she got close enough to see the ship's markings, she identified it as a Presetlin Defense Force fighter. The canopy was closed and she couldn't see the pilot. She jumped off her speeder and clambered onto the fighter's airfoil. She couldn't see through the canopy. She banged on it with her fist and suddenly it popped open. The pilot sat there in his harness, a blaster pointed directly at her face. "Don't shoot!" she screamed, instinctively leveling her own blaster at the man. They froze for a very long moment, weapons leveled at each other. "Well," the pilot said at last, lowering his blaster. "Am I ever glad to see you?" Odie helped him out of his harness, and they crouched on the ground in the lee of the fighter. "Do you have any water?" he asked. She unfastened the 2-liter canteen strapped to her speeder and passed it to him. He drank sparingly and passed it back with thanks. As he did so, he studied his new companion. She was small, and he judged she might be pretty by what he could see of her chin and lips beneath her helmet. Likewise, Odie scrutinized him. A fighter jock. Fighter pilots were the only other people in the army with whom reconnaissance troopers felt any bond. Like the recon troopers, fighter pilots operated on their own, out in front of everyone else, surviving on their guts and skill. At the same instant, each realized what the other was thinking, and they both laughed. "Well," the pilot said, "I guess whatever we're going to do, we'll be doing it together. I'm Irk Harmon. Who are you?" He reached out with one hand. "Trooper Odie Subu, reconnaissance platoon, sir." She took his hand and shook it. "Reconnaissance? That's good. You can get me back to base and I can get back into the fight." The wind had diminished significantly by now. Odie stood. "Sir, follow me," she said, extending her hand to help him up. At that instant, the world around them exploded. The fight for the Intergalactic Communications Center was fierce but short-lived, and the outcome was never in doubt. "Stop!" Raja ordered her technicians as the first battle droids burst into the control room. "Don't resist them. I don't want any of you killed."
"I think, Mistress, that we are about to become prisoners," Slithscale muttered.
He stepped in front of Raja to protect her from the advancing droids, while everyone else was raising his or her hands in surrender. With blows and shoving, the droids forced the technicians into the center of the control room and surrounded them, weapons leveled. "I demand to speak with your commander," Raja said in a voice of authority. A droid darted around Slith and jabbed the muzzle of its blaster into Raja's midsection, knocking the wind out of her. Slith spun about and grabbed her in time to keep her from falling.
"Ah, most touching." A tall, cadaverous figure stepped into the control room. He bowed slightly toward Raja, who stood bent over, gasping in Slith's arms. "May I introduce myself? I am Admiral Pors Tarneth of the Intergalactic Banking Clan, and I am now in charge of this miserable rock."
The dust storm had started up again, and worse, the temperature had plummeted. Odie and Lieutenant Irk Harmon found shelter in a clump of rocks and huddled shivering under the scant protection offered by the ground sheet she had unfolded from her equipment pack.
"What do we do now, sir?"
"Hey, let's get one thing straight. None of this military protocol stuff, okay? I'm Urk and you're Odie. I'm a fighter jock, remember? Not a staff officer.
The massive attack by Tarnath's ships in orbit against General Kamar's army had caught the pair in the open, between the main lines and the fortified position. Both positions had been blasted and then assaulted by ground troops. Unable to do anything to help, they had taken cover and waited for the battle's outcome, which was neither long in coming nor ever in doubt. Using her electrobinoculars, Odie had seen no sign of resistance in either place once the fighting subsided.
"Battle droids," she had said, her voice wavering. "Thousands of them."
Battle droids were on the ridge where General Kamar's army had been camped. And then, as if even the weather were allied with the invaders, the dust storm had started up again, and Odie and Urk had been forced to find precarious shelter.
"How much water do we have?" Urk asked now.
Odie checked her canteen.
"Little less than a liter."
"Well, surrender's no option."
"No."
"Is there any place we can hide out for a while?"
"Let me think."
"There are some caves about 75 kilometers to the southeast of here," she began. "I've seen them on patrols.
We can hide out there.
I don't know what's in them. Maybe there's water. I have a small supply of rations on my speeder.
They'll last us a while if we take it easy."
"Can you get us there in this?"
Urk nodded at the storm all around them.
"Hey, can you fly a fighter?"
"Sure I can get us there."
She laughed without humor.
It took them 2 agonizing days to find the caves. The small amount of water they had was exhausted by the time they reached the shelter, and they were on the verge of dehydration. But at least crawling into the shadowy coolness of the caverns spared them the devastating effects of the broiling sun.
"We've got to find water," Odie gasped.
"You're telling me,"
Urk croaked. They lay resting for a time before regaining enough strength to start the search. Odie produced a brilliant white signal flare from a pouch in her equipment belt to light their way. The piercing flare light cast their shadows huge on the walls around them, like grotesque cave creatures picking their way along.
"Hold it!"
Urk shouted suddenly.
"Move your light over here!"
He indicated a patch of rock that appeared darker than its surroundings. He ran a hand over it.
"Moisture! Water seeping through this rock! We're in business!"
A little farther on, the narrow passage widened abruptly into a huge cavern.
"Listen!"
Urk held up a hand. The cavern floor sloped gradually downward, and as they worked their way toward the bottom, the wonderful sound of running water came distinctly to them from somewhere ahead, where a cool stream of fresh water fed into a deep pond before rushing off to disappear deeper into the cavern. They drank themselves dizzy on the glorious life-giving liquid. They lingered in the caves for 2 days, recuperating.
"We have to move on," Odie said on the evening of the second day, "if for no other reason than we're out of food."
"What say we start out at first light tomorrow?"
Urk suggested.
"How long do you think it'll take us to get to the communication center?"
2, maybe 3 days.
"Can we survive on 2 liters of water for 3 days? All we have to carry it in is this canteen."
"We'll have to.
We've got your speeder.
That'll save us expending all our energy on walking.
We'll take it easy. Conserve body fluid as much as possible."
"Odie, there's nothing you and I together can't do."
He put his arm around her shoulders and kissed her lightly on the cheek. Her face turned even redder than usual. Then she turned and kissed him full on the lips. They held the embrace for a long moment.
"Ah," Urk said at last. "What'd I tell you? You're the best wingmate a fighter jock ever had."
After a moment, Odie said, "I wonder if any of our people survived."
"I'm sure some did. Come on, let's get some sleep."
They lay close together for a long while, not speaking, thinking instead about what might lay ahead of them. Just before he dropped off to sleep, Urk turned to Odie.
"Maybe we're the only 2 left alive on this blasted rock, but we're going to stay that way, right?"
"Absolutely,"
Odie answered. She snuggled closer to Urk's warmth.
But Urk and Odie weren't alone. Not quite.
Just like those parsimonious fools,
Zozrider Slake remarked to one of his officers.
The Republic Senate has always been foolish about defense spending. They leave a strategic place like this to be defended by only a small garrison. What do you expect the Separatists to do, eh? Sit on their hands?
The Republic forces are spread thin, sir, the officer replied, shrugging.
Do we go in now?
Zozrider Slake grinned back.
And give them the surprise of their short lives? You bet. Assemble my commanders.
The atmosphere was tense in the wardroom of Pluriod Botkin, as it always was before going into battle, but there was no nervousness. The officers gathered around the battle charts were charged with the anticipation of action, like a group of Cyborian battle dogs waiting to be released by their handlers.
Mighty crowded out there.
Slake gestured at the holographic chart of the space lanes around Presetlin and Sluis Van.
They outnumber us at least 4-1. Well, now that we're here, does anyone have a plan?
He looked around expectantly.
But, sir, we thought you did,
a man standing next to him blurted out, feigning horror. At this, everyone burst into loud laughter. They all knew that Zozrider Slake definitely had a plan, and they all knew him well enough that they did not need to be told the essence of that plan. Attack, attack, attack. Slake let them enjoy the moment, then held up a hand for quiet.
Let's see. At last report, they had 126 ships in a cordon around Sluis Van. Am I right?
He nodded toward his intelligence chief, who confirmed the figure.
That's bad, because the Sluisi will be occupied defending their own world, but the Separatist fleet will also be busy with its cordon. That's good, because those ships won't be able to interfere with us. The enemy commander has divided his forces. That's good, too.
And the Separatists don't know we're here.
Yet. That's even better.
He pointed a finger at the display of the Sluis sector.
He has about 200 ships in orbit around Presetlin, many of them capital ships.
He nodded again at his intelligence chief.
Your reconnaissance drone reports a big droid army down there.
Yes, sir. They seem to have defeated the defense force and have taken the Intergalactic Communications Center as well. I estimate, from the number of transports on the ground and the quantity of equipment deployed, that the army tops 1 million battle droids.
Well then, they outnumber us. That's very bad, Slake said. But they're only droids. That's good.
More laughter.
Sir, they have managed to block all communications to and from Presetlin, Slake's chief communications officer said. We have to assume the Republic doesn't know what's happened. I don't know how they manage that. It must be new technology.
Slake leaned with both hands on the edge of the display and focused on the enemy ships around Presetlin, bright little blips so numerous that they resembled an asteroid belt around the planet.
We are the only force within striking distance, he said. You all know the importance of Presetlin to the Republic, to our homeworlds, our friends, our families.
He paused, then said quietly,
here's how we're going to do it.
Slake's fleet was small in comparison to the one he was about to attack, consisting of cloak-shaped fighters, gun tugs, and Phoenix Hawk-class light pinnaces. His capital ships consisted of several Carrick-class light cruisers, Corellian corvettes, gunships, and dreadnoughts. While his ground forces were only 50,000 strong, they were highly trained, highly motivated, and equipped with armored vehicles. A reasonable person might think it utter insanity to use a force as small as Slake's to attack Taunoth's army. But Zozrider Slake was not always a reasonable man. He turned to his officers and held up his fist.
We go in like this!
He rammed his fist toward the chart.
A huge armored fist. We'll concentrate all our forces on one sector in their cordon, hit them with everything we've got, and blast open a hole to land the army. It's going to be real hot for our ships in orbit, he added, nodding at his captains. But we'll be counting on you to keep their orbital fleet off balance. Once we're on the ground, we'll close with the enemy and grab him by the belt, hold him tight. That way, his fleet won't be able to attack us without fear of hitting his own forces.
He paused. We're about to cross a bridge, and once over, we're burning it behind us. It's do or die.
They all knew that. Once on the ground, Slake's army could not be reinforced if things went badly. Failure was just not an option. But Slake was no overconfident fool.
I have dispatched a message to Coruscant requesting reinforcements.
He shrugged.
Perhaps they can spare a Jedi or two.
This caused laughter. Everyone knew how much Slake despised the Jedi.
You will have your operations orders before you get back to your ships, Slake announced.
But they were not yet dismissed. This was Zoe's Rider Slake's great moment. He had risked everything, even became an outlaw with a price on his head, to get to this place with his army at this crucial instant in time. He saw himself now as the fulcrum of history.
Remember who you are,
he shouted. What you are about to undertake is not done for fame or reward or ambition. You are not compelled into this fight by necessity like slaves. We go into battle now out of simple duty to our people.
Slake paused. There were tears in some eyes, all of which were focused on their commander. Slake took a deep breath.
Freedom, sons and daughters, expect every person to do his duty.
Odie and Urk didn't get far from the caves before once again the ground beneath and the air about them heaved and reverberated to the sounds of battle, this time somewhat farther away.
General Kamar must be counterattacking, Odie said, removing her helmet.
Urk pulled aside the ground sheet that he was using to protect his face from wind-blown sand particles and searched the sky.
I don't think so.
Look!
He pointed to the north, where just above the horizon, bright fingers of flame lanced down from the heavens. The sky there suddenly exploded in brilliant flashes, followed seconds later by a deep rumbling. One of the flame pillars descending down toward the ground blossomed into a brilliant chrysanthemum of fire.
Ships are landing, he shouted. One was just hit. It's a relief force. Coruscant sent a relief force.
He threw his arms around Odie and impulsively kissed her on the cheek. Odie was so surprised and pleased, she didn't know how to react. So she blurted out quickly.
Sergeant McGinnity said recon troopers always ride to the sound of the guns. Shall we?
Turn this thing around and let's go.
But when Odie depressed the foot pedal, the speeder's motor only whined feebly.
Out of power?
Urk hoped he didn't sound as worried as he felt. He hopped off the speeder so that Odie could access the power cell compartment housed in the rear.
No, she said. And these things are usually maintenance-free.
Here, look at this.
Urk pointed to a small hole in the housing cover. He felt the hole with a finger.
You've been shot. Feel the edges around this hole. It was burned through.
I did have a run-in with some enemy troopers, she said, popping the cover. As they stood looking down into the compartment, the cell gave a little pop, and a thin tendril of smoke rose upward.
That's it, she said. We're foot mobile now.
How far do you think we are from the center? He asked.
Maybe 75 or 100 kilometers, she replied.
Can we make it on foot?
Odie shook her canteen.
If we can conserve our water.
We are what?
Taunith shrieked, jumping to his feet and spilling some tea down the front of his white robe when his chief of staff told him they were being attacked.
By whom? Full details, he demanded.
Apparently, sir, we were being shadowed by another force. They couldn't have come from Coruscant or Sluis Van, and they had to be small to avoid our detection.
Taunith impatiently waved a hand at Karaxk.
Get on with it!
Already his mind was working. He didn't like surprises, but one had to deal with them. By the time the Bothan finished with his report, his fur was continually rippling, but the worse the news became, the calmer Tarnith grew.
Sir,
Karax ventured,
I believe you should have stayed with the fleet. The ships are being thrown into confusion.
Tarnith held up a hand.
No, the issue shall be decided here, not in orbit.
He paused.
They are much smaller than our force. They are behind us. Here is what they'll do. They will attempt to close with us as soon as possible, get close enough so our ships in orbit won't be able to fire on them for fear of hitting us. We should expect a flexible battle plan and plenty of individual initiative. They'd have to have that and boldness to attack us like this.
We'll let them attack us all they want.
When their strength is depleted, that's when we'll counterattack.
Supreme Chancellor Palpatine made a series of calls, one of them to Senator Paige Tarkin. Paige Tarkin had never seen the Chancellor looking this worried, holonet transceiver image or not.
This is a matter of the utmost urgency. I need to see you at once.
Where shall we meet?
My apartment, as quickly as you can get here. I must...
Your apartment, Supreme Chancellor? She blurted. Not your office?
Palpatine shook his head.
This is a matter of the utmost sensitivity. It's best if nobody knows about the meeting yet. Now I must invite some others, so please excuse me.
The image vanished before she could ask who the others might be. Maas Amida received the next call. As Speaker of the Senate and a loyal follower of the Supreme Chancellor, Amida was best known for keeping his mouth shut and maintaining order during Senate debates. Then Palpatine summoned Jani Hanuk of Glythnos, a senior member of the Security and Intelligence Council. Hanuk saw everything in terms of profit and loss to herself. Although of a somewhat independent mind, she had also voted to grant Palpatine his emergency powers. Next on the list was Armand Isard, Director of Republic Intelligence, a man who knew much but said little. Finally, Palpatine called Sate Pestage, Controller of the Senate's Executive Agenda. Pestage was a master of persuasion. Many times since Palpatine's assumption of emergency powers, Pestage had convinced recalcitrant senators to get behind the Supreme Chancellor. Thus, Supreme Chancellor Palpatine gathered his staunchest allies to deal with his enemies. Palpatine's apartment was comfortable, but not ostentatious, as befit an abstemious public servant in the service of the people.
I apologize again for getting you all here on such short notice,
Palpatine opened as his guests settled in.
I will come straight to the point. A very powerful separatist force has captured Presidlin. A much smaller force, a rogue force in fact, is opposing the invasion, but the outcome of this opposition is very much in doubt. Armand, give us the facts as we know them.
A Trade Federation invasion force. We don't know its size or composition, but must assume it is very large and very potent, has taken Presidlin. We must assume, because all contact has broken off, that they are now holding the Intergalactic Communication Center. We must also assume that they are preparing to use the planet as a springboard for further incursions into the core worlds. We received this information in a message sent by the commander of the force the Supreme Chancellor mentioned, which had been shadowing the invasion fleet for some time. Paige Tarkin gasped,
Have they made any move against the Sesuena sector?
Not that we know of, Palpatine answered. But they have some means of blocking transmission, so anything is possible. We do know that they have invested Srisvan with another fleet of about 125 ships of different classes, evidently a holding operation, not an outright invasion. We must assume that once they've consolidated their hold on Presidlin, yes, they will move against Sesuena, Senator, either by force or by argument.
We're making a lot of assumptions here. How do we know all this?
Jani Hanuk asked, looking first at Palpatine and then at Izzard. The Chancellor nodded at Izzard to continue.
We received intelligence of this event from Captain Zoe's Rider Slake.
The pirate? Hanuk interjected. Palpatine smiled. Not anymore. I pardoned him.
And a good thing you did,
Izzard added.
Because right now, he and his army, the Sons and Daughters of Freedom, as they call themselves, are all that is opposing the separatist force on Presidlin.
Who is commanding the invaders? Hanuk asked.
Through other sources, Izzard replied, smiling cryptically, we think it might be Paws Tarneth of the Intergalactic Banking Clan.
He glanced over at Palpatine, who nodded that he should proceed.
We don't know much about Tarneth, but he is no pushover. As a financier, he is known for his ruthlessness, applying almost military precision and determination against his rivals. Apparently, he's had some success leading military operations, too. Anyway, the last message we had from Slake was that he was about to attack.
How big is his force? Masamita asked.
I'm not sure how many capital ships, but it's estimated he has an army of 50,000 beings.
Great balls of fire, Paige Tarkin exclaimed. And he's going up against a whole separatist army with a force that small? Unbelievable.
The guests all looked at one another in astonishment. Palpatine steepled his fingers, carefully placing the tips beneath his nose. So, he began, the situation is desperate. As you all know, our deployable forces are all engaged throughout the galaxy. I do not believe that Captain Slake, despite his obvious qualities of bravery and resourcefulness, will be able to expel the invaders. He can only upset them, delay them, and even if he does succeed in this, no doubt the Trade Federation is planning on sending an overwhelming follow-on force to secure Presidlin.
What forces do we have that we can spare? Hanuk asked.
Palpatine shifted in his chair and stretched his legs.
The garrison force on Sentax 1, some 20,000 clones.
He shrugged. We shall have to commit them. They're all we have that are immediately available.
And who shall command this expedition? Paige Tarkin asked.
Palpatine straightened, smoothed his robes, turned toward her, and smiled.
A Jedi Master, he said.
Jedi Najah Halcyon had no idea why he had been summoned so suddenly to appear before the Jedi Council. He had already been reprimanded for his failure. Perhaps, after the long period of idleness imposed on him because of the Scarlet Thranta affair, the Jedi Council was ready to reinstate him? He desperately wanted a chance to redeem himself. Perhaps the summons was it. 11 of the 12 members of the Jedi Council sat in a semicircle, just as he remembered from the last time he had stood before them.
Welcome, Najah, Mace Windu said.
Halcyon bowed. Yoda smiled.
Since we last saw you, a long time it has been.
Yes, Master, too long.
We have an assignment for you, Mace Windu said.
He gave Halcyon a searching look.
Supreme Chancellor Palpatine himself recommended you for this mission.
Halcyon tried not to show his surprise.
I do not know the Chancellor personally, but I am honored he should have such confidence in me, Master. Why did he recommend me?
You don't know why the Supreme Chancellor recommended you? Master Windu asked.
No, I don't.
Are you familiar with Presidlin and the Sluis sector?
Master Windu asked abruptly.
Only that we have an important communications relay there, but I've never been there.
Briefly, Windu explained what had happened. Halcyon listened with growing wonder. This was indeed a major assignment, and it was an honor to be entrusted with it.
You will be interested in knowing who it is that is in command of the opposing force,
Windu said when he finished describing the situation and the mission.
Yes, indeed.
That man is Zoe's Rider Slake, Master Windu stated.
There was a moment of silence in the Jedi Council chamber. Then Halcyon cleared his throat and nodded briskly.
Captain Slake is a good soldier.
Yoda smiled, and the other members of the council visibly relaxed.
To hear you say that is good.
He nodded at Mace. Mace Windu spoke in rapid, clipped tones, as if reading a set of orders.
Najah Halcyon, you will take a relief force of 20,000 clones to Presidlin. Once there, you will effect a landing of your army, assume overall command of the combined force, and destroy the Techno-Union army there. You are authorized to dispose your ground and naval forces according to the battle plan you and your staff will devise en route to accomplish this mission in the most expeditious and effective way possible. He paused. You may select your own staff and designate whomever you wish to be your second in command. Time is short. You will effect the departure with all possible haste.
I am honored to accept this mission, Halcyon said formally.
This Slake! Work with him you can. Toward him no animosity you feel still over his stealing of your ship?
Halcyon bowed deeply.
No, Master Yoda. Slake is an intelligent and resourceful soldier. I was overconfident and foolish, and he exploited my weakness. I am glad, he finished with a smile, to have him as my ally, and I know together we shall smash the Techno-Union forces.
Yoda nodded.
Of our order, Najah Halcyon, a true master you are.
Do you have anyone in mind who might be your deputy on this expedition?
Windu asked.
Yes, Master. Anakin Skywalker.
Anakin flexed the fingers of his prosthetic hand and regarded the fist it made. The prosthesis that had replaced his right arm and hand was even better than the original. He rose to his feet. The grotto where Najah Halcyon had asked to meet with him was one of many situated at various levels throughout the Jedi Temple. The bench he'd been sitting on was shaded by the overhanging branches from the trees that grew around the pool into which a waterfall splashed. A light mist hung over the pool, condensing on the path where he stood. Altogether, this was a very pleasant spot. But Anakin Skywalker was in no mood for pleasant spots this day. He walked down the path a short distance, did an abrupt about-face, and stalked back to the bench. He'd been weeks on Coruscant, studying, practicing his skills. Under the circumstances, he'd rather be spending his time with Padme.
No, don't think of that, he told himself. Think of the future. Master Halcyon was going to offer him something. That had to be why he'd asked for this meeting.
Coruscant was rife with rumors these days. Everyone was talking vaguely about new threats from the Separatist forces. Big things were afoot, and Anakin itched to be a part of it all. Jedi Najah Halcyon. Anakin had gotten to know him rather well during the time of his enforced idleness. Anakin respected Master Halcyon, but could not understand what had gone wrong on the mission to Bip Vash, which had ended in such great embarrassment to him and the Jedi Order. Specific details about the mission had been kept quiet. But still, there was talk. Anakin assumed Halcyon had been recalled to Coruscant because the Jedi Council was trying to decide on his future employments, but he was too polite to ask. What really mattered to Anakin, though, was that Halcyon seemed to like and have confidence in him, and now that might be about to pay off. He sensed Halcyon's approach and turned to greet him at the same moment that Halcyon said,
"A credit for your thoughts?"
Both men smiled. Halcyon draped an arm across Anakin's shoulder.
"My young friend," he announced, "I have come with news. The Jedi Council is sending us on a mission. I've been given a chance to prove myself."
"No, don't deny it, Anakin. That's what this assignment is, a trial. And I've asked for you to be my second in command." The Council agreed.
"What is the mission, Master?"
"Are you familiar with the Intergalactic Communication Center on Presidlin, in the Sluice Sector?"
"Not really. I know it's a vital communications hub, but I don't know much more than that."
"It's been seized by a Separatist force. We're assuming the garrison has been defeated, but the enemy force is being opposed by a friendly armada that was tracking the invasion fleet and has broken through the cordon around Presidlin. They are now heavily engaged with the Separatist ground force. We are going to relieve that army if it can be done."
He paused. "We're not sure how big the Separatist force is,
but it's very powerful. Taking it on will not be an easy job. Who's in command of the intervening force on Presetlin? Halcyon smiled weakly.
Zoe's rider Slake.
Anakin looked up sharply.
You mean...
Yes, the same. My nemesis.
Halcyon's lips twisted in a wry smile.
But we are going to retake Presetlin, Anakin. If Slake's still alive and able to fight by the time we get there, well, he'll be so glad to see us, I don't think I'll have any problem working with him.
Neither said anything for a long moment.
Master, what precisely will be my role as your second?
We'll have an army of 20,000 clones. We'll form it into two divisions. I'll hold overall command, as well as command of one division, and you'll command the other. If anything happens to me, you will then command the entire fleet.
When do we leave?
Soon. Very soon.
So what's our first step? Anakin asked.
Our first step? Well, first you and I are going to meet someone very special.
No society is without its underworld. With more than a trillion inhabitants, Coruscant, the gem of the galaxy, the hub of the Republic, had its bottom feeders deep beneath its soaring spires. Coruscant was like a vast ocean. While luxurious liners full of happy partiers plowed the waves on the surface, hideous denizens, strangers to light, lurked in the murky depths far below. It was into this world that Jedi Master Najah Halcyon took Anakin. The Golden Slug, a rundown flophouse with a sleazy bar in the lobby, was the only spot of activity on a dead-end side street just off a main underground thoroughfare. The sign above the Golden Slug's doorway sputtered. Golden Slug, it announced, two of the letters long since broken in some drunken melee. The lobby was a shambles. Most of the furniture that was still intact was unoccupied, except for something snoring loudly on one of the couches. Several patrons sat at the bar on one side of the lobby. An unprepossessing figure hunched alone at one end of the bar. Three other barflies sat at the opposite end, as far from the figure as they could get, studiously ignoring its presence.
Grudo!
Halcyon shouted. The lobby went deadly silent. The hunched figure turned slowly, stepped to its feet, and moved toward them. Anakin blinked. It had bumpy green skin and bulging multifaceted eyes. A stubby pair of antennae protruded from its head. Numerous sheathed knives hung from two bandoliers crossing its chest, and more knives rested uneasily in scabbards on its belt. A pair of blasters sat in holsters on its belt. Anakin thought he could make out other tools of the bounty hunter's trade poking out here and there. This being was the meanest-looking Rodian Anakin had ever seen, and he headed straight toward them. Anakin reached again for his lightsaber, but Halcyon held him back with a steadying arm. The Rodian's hands were empty. As soon as he got within reach, the bounty hunter lurched forward and grabbed Halcyon around the waist and danced him around in a macabre circle.
"Halcyon," he hooted. "It's good to see you, old friend."
"This is Grudo,"
Halcyon told Anakin as soon as he was able to disentangle himself. "Grudo, this young Jedi is Anakin Skywalker." Anakin smiled crookedly and said, "Hello." The Rodian released Halcyon and stood at attention.
"Jedi Anakin Skywalker, Sergeant Grudo reporting,"
he said in an impeccable basic that contrasted sharply with his appearance.
"I'm pleased to make your acquaintance, sir."
"Sergeant?" Anakin asked. "I didn't know bounty hunters had ranks."
"Come,"
Grudo commanded, and led them to the bar.
"Barkeep, come out from wherever you're hiding. I want to buy a drink for my friends."
The bartender, a nervous, sallow-faced human, edged up from his hiding place. Looking like he was ready to drop back down to safety at any moment, he poured a dirty yellow fluid out of a bottle containing some kind of root into glasses that looked none too clean. Grudo raised his glass in a toast. Halcyon and Anakin followed suit.
"Woo!"
Halcyon gasped. Grudo patted him hard between the shoulder blades.
Strong stuff,
the Jedi Master wheezed, thumping his chest with a fist. Anakin sipped cautiously at his drink. The liquid burned its way past his lips, over his tongue, down his throat, and into the depths of his stomach, where it exploded in a ball of blazing fire. He choked.
Good,
he rasped.
Very good. Thank you, Grudo.
Grudo laughed at Anakin's feeble attempt to hide his discomfort.
There's nothing good about the taste of that drink. It's supposed to incapacitate Gamorreans, Trandoshans, Wookiees, and other large species, so Rodian bounty hunters can take them into custody without getting hurt.
I don't feel in the least incapacitated, Grudo. Are you sure you need to tranquilize a large person to capture him? Grudo laughed and slapped Anakin on the back.
Maybe, if I was a bounty hunter.
If you're not a bounty hunter, what are you doing on Coruscant? I thought the only people your world allowed to leave home were bounty hunters.
If I don't tell, you can't tell,
the Rodian whispered conspiratorially. Then he turned to Halcyon.
Do you have a job for me, Najah?
Possibly.
There's trouble on Precedlin, I hear.
The two Jedi glanced at each other in surprise.
How do you know that?
Anakin demanded. Grudo shrugged noncommittally.
Word gets around.
Halcyon sighed. Well, if they know about our mission here, the Separatists know too, or they will soon. He gave his drink a suspicious look and pushed the dirty glass aside, then said to Anakin,
Grudo isn't a bounty hunter. He's an old soldier. He's been in more battles and on more campaigns than most regular soldiers. He's led troops in battle his whole life. I want him to come with us. He'll be a good addition to our team, especially when it comes to directing small unit operations.
He turned to Grudo.
Will you come with us?
So you two are going to be generals on this mission.
Halcyon flinched and muttered.
Nobody's supposed to know that.
Grudo smiled.
You're going to need a good sergeant major, especially the whelp here.
He flung a surprisingly strong arm across Anakin's shoulders.
Let's have one last drink. For old times. And for the future.
He leaned over the bar to peer at the cowering bartender.
Give us a round of the good stuff this time.
Both Lieutenant Irk Harmon and Recon Trooper Odie Subu had received survival training and were well aware of the dangers of dehydration. But neither had been prepared for this long walk through the high desert region, and it proved much more difficult than either had anticipated. By noon on the second day, they were in serious trouble. They found a rock outcropping and flopped down in its shade.
Let's rest here a while,
Irk croaked. Odie didn't bother to reply, but dropped down, raising a cloud of dust. They lay there in the intense heat and panted. Dimly, Irk became aware that Odie was saying something.
What?
He rasped, but she didn't answer immediately.
What did you say?
Let's head back home, Tammy, she answered. It's time for chow.
Tammy? Oh, yes. Wasn't he one of Odie's buddies?
Irk had difficulty remembering exactly. Anyway, he thought it was someone she had mentioned.
Odie,
Irk gasped. But too exhausted to point out that she was hallucinating, he just rolled over on his back. The heat enveloped them like a scorching blanket, despite the shade provided by the rock overhang. And as the minutes dragged by and the sun moved gradually, even that slight protection began to disappear. Gradually, everything was happening in slow motion now. Irk became aware that something was blocking the sunlight. He squinted up at it. It was huge. It spread its enormous wings and made a terrible squawking noise. A giant beak filled with razor-sharp teeth fastened onto one of Odie's legs and bit it off. Dimly, Irk was aware that there was no such creature native to Precedlin. But here it was anyway. As it threw back its head to swallow the limb, Irk drew his sidearm with his last remaining strength and fired. Watching an army preparing to embark on a campaign is one of the most exciting experiences in life. second only to being shot at and missed. Grudo the Rodian had been shot at and missed many times, but even he caught the tempo of the moment as the fleet based on Sentax 1 prepared for war. While the Republic's available ground forces were limited to the 20,000 clones now embarking on the waiting ships, fortunately, its naval forces were of considerable potency, consisting of many capital ships. Enough, Halcyon reasoned, to break through the Separatist fleet he would encounter blockading Presidlin. Halcyon had chosen as his flagship the Sentax-class heavy frigate Ranger. Built by the expert shipwrights of Sluis Van and outfitted in the shipyard on Sentax 1, the Ranger was a fast and powerful vessel, equipped with the latest weaponry and auxiliary systems. It was on this ship that Halcyon held his first council of war as the fleet readied to depart. "We have deployable ground forces of 20,000 clones. I will form them into two divisions. I'll command one and Anakin the other. As I see it, each division should consist of four brigades of four battalions, each with four infantry companies. This will give us great maneuverability in the attack. And..." Grudo snorted.
"I thought you knew better than that, Halcyon. Divide your divisions by threes. Three brigades, each with three battalions of three companies."
"What?" Halcyon asked. "I think what he means," Anakin interjected, "is that two up, one back is not only the standard military formation, but also a more powerful structure. With larger formations, you have more combat power. You attack with two brigades or battalions or companies and keep one in reserve. At least, that's what it looks like in everything I've studied." Halcyon nodded ruefully. "I stand corrected, then. We'll organize our troops in a triangular formation. On to logistics," he went on quickly. Anakin listened intently. The next days passed in a whirlwind of activity. The two Jedi and their Rodian comrade soon began to work as a well-oiled team. Grudo followed Anakin everywhere, interjecting advice whenever appropriate, but otherwise not saying much. The clone infantry had been divided among several transports in order to minimize their losses if a ship was hit, so the trio were kept busy moving among the ships. At night, they met in Halcyon's stateroom to go over the details of the day. One evening, Halcyon asked Anakin, "Are you familiar with the capabilities of the specialized troopers?" He was referring to the 50 clone commandos aboard the battlecruiser Tear. Anakin nodded. Clone commandos were trained to be used for only the most dangerous missions. Equipped with highly advanced armor and weapons, they were capable of fighting successfully on their own, but with a Jedi commander, their potential as an attack force was virtually unlimited.
"They're yours, then," Halcyon told him. "Take Grudo, go over to the Tear, and get to know them."
Surprised and pleased, Anakin wasted no time getting a shuttle to the cruiser. The captain in charge of the commandos called them to attention when Anakin entered their bay. Anakin traded salutes with the captain. "At ease," he commanded. He spread his legs slightly and clasped his hands behind his back as he scanned the soldiers before him. There were two sergeants in the group, judging by the green markings on their armor. "I am Commander Anakin Skywalker," he began. "You have been assigned to the 2nd Division, which I command. You will serve as part of my headquarters battalion, under my personal direction. Captain, you will not report to or receive orders from any other officer during this campaign. I will assign you missions as required by the tactical situation on Presidlin. I will not ask you to do anything that I wouldn't do myself. Is that clear?"
"Aru!"
the troopers shouted in unison, coming to attention with a loud slamming of boots on the deck. The captain permitted himself a slight smile.
"My troopers are ready, sir," he reported.
Anakin glanced at Grudo, whose face was pulled down in the Rodian smile. "Captain, have the troopers fall out and fall in by their assigned bunks. I wish to inspect their armor, weapons, and equipment." Anakin spent the rest of the night inspecting the troopers. He found no dust, grease, or dirty weapons. Throughout the inspection, the captain followed Anakin with a data pad at the ready, but he was never told to enter anything. On the way back to the Ranger, Grudo leaned over and told Anakin,
"You did a good job with that inspection. You looked at everything you should and weren't petty, like some might have been.
The troopers appreciate that. They'll fight well for you. I can tell.
Someone was pouring water over Odie's face. She opened her eyes and saw a shadowy figure bending over her. She tried to speak and managed to croak.
Irk!
Yes, the shadowy figure standing over her said.
Irk!
She said again, mustering what she could of her returning strength to get the name out. But the voice that responded was strange.
Who are...
was all she could get out. Sergeant Omen Lalox at your service, the shadow replied.
Who did you expect?
Pilot,
she gasped.
The flyboy?
We're pumping him up too. We put him under another shelter, give you room to breathe under here.
My partner is Corporal Jamer Nath.
Come on, can you get up? He poured more liquid into Odie's mouth. She felt less groggy and managed, with a little bit of help, to sit up. She looked around, but didn't see anybody other than Irk and the two recon troopers.
What are you doing here? She asked.
Scouting. The Separatists have patrols out all over the place, looking for weak spots to hit. It's our job to find them and disrupt their plans, and report any maneuver units we find trying to circle our positions. He changed the subject.
What happened to you two? If you hadn't fired that shot, we'd never have known you were here, and you'd both be dead by now.
I don't remember firing a shot, she stammered.
Well, must have been your boyfriend over there. Or you just don't remember doing it. When you get into the last stages of death by dehydration, you hallucinate all over the place. But I suppose you know that.
We saw the flash and came to investigate. Whoever it was fired straight up into the air. We figured it was a signal.
Who are you?
I'm a recon trooper, just like you. Come on, let's get you on your feet and moving. You could ride in the back of my speeder. That sidearm of yours, can you use it?
Yes, but where'd you come from? You weren't part of General Kamar's army.
No, we weren't. We'll explain everything later. Right now, my first priority is to get out of this desert and back into our positions before one of their patrols spots us. Come on, take my hand. Let's get going. Odie staggered slightly as she stepped out from under the shelter half, involuntarily raising a hand to shield her eyes from the brilliant sunlight.
Here,
Lalox said, handing her a helmet.
Put it on. It's a spare.
Gratefully, Odie donned the helmet, a standard recon trooper's multi-purpose field operating unit. There stood Irk with the other trooper beside his speeder.
You ride with me, trooper,
Lalox said.
Come on!
He called to Corporal Nath.
Let's get out of here!
Rapidly, Lalox repacked some of the gear in his speeder to make room for Odie.
Hold tight, he cautioned.
Odie knew from the instant the sergeant put his machine into motion that he was an expert. Cautiously, Lalox guided them over some extremely rough terrain. He stopped below the crest of a long ridge.
Just below us is a dried-up riverbed. We'll follow that almost all the way back. Do you know it?
Yes. Your base is near the Intergalactic Communications Center?
Right. We occupy the center and the foreground below the plateau. We're dug in front of them. Our rear is in this direction. Their fleet can't intervene because ours is holding them too close. The first day we fought off waves of battle droids, but we held our lines. Now we've settled down into positional warfare, sniping at each other and sending out patrols to find weak places in the lines. It's a standoff. Whoever gets reinforcements first wins.
Are reinforcements coming?
Ours? I don't know. Our commander sent a message to Coruscant before we attacked, before we entered the zone where the enemy managed to block all other transmissions.
Theirs?
Yeah, they probably planned big reinforcements before they attacked.
Draw your weapon.
I'll drive, you shoot.
Odie drew her blaster and took it off safe.
I'm ready, she said.
They descended rapidly into the riverbed. They were attacked at a point where the river rose to the surface in a floodplain. The first bolt sizzled between Odie and Lalox so close it singed the cloth on his shirt and burned the tip of her nose as it passed. Odie swiveled and fired in the direction the shot had come from. And then she saw them. Three 74Z speeders coming like the wind across the floodplain. Lalox jumped his speeder over the low bank and gunned it directly at the attackers. Badly aimed blaster bolts sizzled past them.
Odie leaned around his right arm and snapped off two more blasts. She could clearly see one hit a speeder, but its armor absorbed the energy and bled it out onto the sand as an electrical discharge. The other hit the rider she had aimed at, and he flipped backward over the tail of his machine.
Woo-wee!
Someone, it sounded like Irk, yelled over the comm. Odie glanced to her left. A few meters behind them, and a bit off to the side, she could see Irk leaning forward around Corporal Nath's side, firing methodically at the two remaining enemy speeders.
Break! Break!
Lalak shouted. He swerved to the right so sharply that Odie's knees scraped the ground as he roared around the oncoming troopers. The maneuver confused the attackers. Behind them, instantly and at 200 kilometers per hour, Lalox aimed his speeder at the closest enemy rider, who broke to his left sharply. Lalox followed him around, keeping close on his tail. Odie kept firing, but her bolts disappeared harmlessly into the enemy speeder's armor. A huge cloud of dust rose up to cover the melee as the speeders pirouetted desperately around each other, seeking to ram their opponents or gain an opening for a shot that would count. The dust, thick and choking in the windless air, clung to them like a second skin and blinded them. Suddenly, Lalak stopped his speeder and took off his helmet. Odie was taken aback by the utter silence.
"Where are they?"
she whispered, swiveling her head, listening carefully for the sound of the other speeders. There was none.
"Good shot," Lalak whispered, meaning the one with which Odie had hit the first enemy trooper.
"I can't raise my partner," he added. "He must be down."
The wind grew stronger and the dust began clearing rapidly. Like a curtain being rolled back from a stage whereon a tragedy was about to unfold, the dust cloud trailed away on the wind to reveal, not 10 meters from where they were standing, an enemy trooper sitting on his speeder. He was looking away from them. Before Odie could swing around and fire, Lalox leapt off the speeder, sprinted across the space between them, and smashed into the enemy trooper. The enemy trooper was big, and he wasn't human. The two grunted and cursed in different languages as they rolled in the dust. But the advantage was with the enemy trooper, who wasn't as stunned as Lalox had thought. Odie ran up and leveled her blaster at them.
"Surrender or I'll shoot!" she shouted.
No good. She risked hitting Lalox if she fired. She holstered her piece and jumped into the fray. The enemy trooper grunted as Odie's weight came down on his back, but he didn't loosen his grip on Lalox's throat. He stood up slowly, holding Lalox by the neck with one arm and shaking him. With the other hand, he reached over his shoulder, grabbed Odie by the head, and wrenched her off his back. He flung her away like a doll. She crashed and rolled in the dust, stunned. He dropped Lalox to the ground, put a massive foot on his chest, and drew a mace-like weapon from his belt. Lalox lay half-stunned, gasping for breath. The enemy trooper, a Gamorrean, whirled the mace around his head several times, grunting victoriously in his own language. A blaster bolt hit the Gamorrean in the right pectoral. He grunted in pain and dropped the mace. With his left hand, he drew his own sidearm and fired. Odie was finally able to get off a shot and hit him squarely between the shoulders. A parasitical mort fastened between the Gamorrean's left shoulder, detached itself, and burrowed into the sand as its host staggered, whirled, and fired back. But his shot went wild and hit Lalox's speeder instead. Another bolt hit the Gamorrean in the lower spine, forcing him to his knees. Unable to turn around and shoot back, he fired again in the direction where Odie lay. But now Lalox found his blaster, and he put 3 quick bolts into the Gamorrean, who finally crumpled to the ground and lay still. Irk walked up, and with one arm, he helped Lalox to his feet. Odie limped up.
"Are you all right?"
"Where's my trooper?"
Lalox asked before Irk could say anything. "I'm sorry, Sarge. He was killed. I'm sorry about your man. I really am." Lalox nodded.
"My speeder is trash, but we now have 2 serviceable 74Zs. I'm going to collect my partner's body.
Where'd you leave Jamer?"
Irk pointed. "That way, about 0.5 kilometer.
"I need those reinforcements, my lord.
pause, Tarnath said to the image of Count Dooku floating in front of him. The Count's somber features twitched in annoyance.
I thought I told you to deal with Commander Ventress on all operational matters.
This operation will fail without those reinforcements, Tarnath continued, ignoring Dooku's displeasure.
You will learn to follow my orders.
At Dooku's meaningful look, Tarnath blanched. I am following your orders, my lord, he said hastily. They are to capture and secure this planet. The plan you devised for this campaign, which I